Excuse me, this is the conference coordinator. I would like to inform all participants this call is now being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you. Trina, do you want to start or do you want me to?
You can go ahead.
Okay. Welcome, everybody, to the November 25th Charm Telecon. Today we have three speakers who are going to talk about Enceladus, results of recent Cassini flybys of the active moon. With us today, we have Paul Helfenstein from the imaging team, John Spencer from the SIRS team, and Sasha Kemp from the CDA team. Now, for those of you on the phone, the PDF version, which is on the public website, has been combined into one document. However, the PowerPoint documents, we left them in their original format because each of our speakers had a beautiful presentation. We didn't want to lose the lose all of the background material by combining them. We're going to start this particular talk with Trina Ray, who's going to give us just a few slides worth of introductory material, which is also on the PDF at the beginning, and it has a separate PowerPoint. So with that, Trina, I'll give it to you.
Okay, welcome everyone to the Charm Telecon today. As Jane said, we really do have some very exciting material to be presented. Enceladus has turned out to be one of the most exciting targets that Cassini has studied. Even back as far as many years ago as Voyager, we knew that Enceladus was going to be interesting, but it has just turned out to be sort of interesting beyond our wildest expectations. The second slide in the presentation, this is a nice view or picture of the flybys that are coming up. Now, we had three flybys in the main mission, in Cassini's prime mission, and it was near the first flyby that the magnetometer instrument sort of noticed something interesting about Enceladus in particular, something going on towards the south. It was the second flyby where we really got some fantastic data from the SIRS instrument and the INMS instrument, where we saw the hot spot at the south and also flew through the water cloud. And then it was later in 2005 when we took those first very, very spectacular images near actually Thanksgiving of 2005. So that was it was really nice, and that's where we really saw the plume. So this picture here shows the plume that's shooting out of the south pole of Enceladus, and it shows the trajectories of the flybys that are happening in the 2005 flyby, but then also the ones that have happened this year and the ones that will be upcoming. And you can see that we've got some exciting sort of, you know, diagonal flybys where you go very close to the equator and then sort of shoot through the plume, but you're further away from the sort of the source of the jets when you're flying through the plume. But then notice right there those E7, E9 flybys that shoot right across the middle. Those are going to happen next year, and we're really, really looking forward to those flybys. So this gives you sort of a nice, quick overview of the trajectories of the Cassini spacecraft near and through near Enceladus and through the plumes for the extended mission that we're in right now. If we go into the next slide, slide number three, all the instruments have just been doing fantastic stuff at Enceladus, and it really, it's one of those things where it's sort of a, you know, it takes a village. Any one instrument alone, you would be challenged to understand what's going on, but all of them together really help you put together the full, rich story that is the Enceladus, that is this little moon, Enceladus. We've got information that we'll be presenting today on its surface, and I think perhaps Paul will be talking about composition perhaps, but also we definitely have some thermal presentations that will be done today, and dust results that will be presented today from the scientists who are joining us. If we go on to the next slide, which is slide number four in the package, this shows you the upcoming flybys. The upcoming flybys in 2009 and 2010, this is what will wrap up the Cassini extended mission. You'll see in particular those E7 and E9 that just shoot across right through the plume, right through the jets. Those are some that are really have some exciting potential, and really looking forward to those flybys that are coming. And with that, that's the conclusion of the introductory material. We'll go ahead and hand it off to Dr. Paul Helfenstein, who's with us from Cornell today.
Howdy. You all right? Okay, let's see. Let me get started here. We're going to be talking right now about a little bit of surface geology that we've been doing with the high-resolution imaging, but I think I need to get us oriented on our area of geologic interest. If you go to the next slide, you'll see three images, whole disk images of Enceladus. Up until about 2008, our best imaging was done from three close flybys, all in 2005. Of those three, the only one that really showed us a good view of the South Pole, where the action is, was on the 11th orbit, on Rev 11, and that was in July of 2005. Now, what's particularly interesting about this and relevant to what I'm going to talk about today is that we managed to get one image during that time at an extraordinarily high spatial resolution of 4 meters per pixel, and that drove a lot of the planning that's led to the images that I'm going to show you today. In any event, if you go to the next slide, okay, this sort of focuses a little bit more on orienting us toward our area of interest. This is a false color mosaic of Enceladus taken with the Cassini narrow angle camera. There are three wavelengths used here: an ultraviolet wavelength, a green wavelength, and an infrared wavelength. So it's a false color image, and in this image, areas that are greenish are areas that represent ice that has a fairly coarse grain size. In other words, according to Porco et al., 2006, we'd estimate the grain sizes in these greenish areas as being about 100 microns or so in diameter. The whiter areas in this representation represent finer frost of frost particles, more with diameters closer to 10 microns. So what you can see right away is that the tiger stripes stand out. The tiger stripes are actually called tiger stripes because when we first saw them at low resolution and low angle, they actually did look like dark stripes in contrast to the brighter material. So as higher resolution view, tiger stripes are about 130 kilometers long. They're spaced about 35 kilometers apart, and they appear greenish because, as I say, for some reason, coarser particles lined with the rift. Okay, so the area as a whole, you'll see lettering A, B, and C. This is basically a tectonic boundary that isolates the South Pole region from the rest of Enceladus. So this is sort of in comparison to the other terrains on Enceladus, there are very few craters. It's a very young area, and we know that it's geologically, volcanically, and tectonically active. We don't have, in particular, the area that the band that isolates it from the rest of Enceladus is a sub-kilometer scale scarp that actually encircles the South Pole. The South Pole is just about dead center of where you see the tiger stripes, and so that you have this prominent arcuate scarp. In some places, it intersects to form these sharp cuts. In other areas where it intersects, there are icy mountains being wedged and pushed up in between the cuts. We're not going to be talking about that so much today, but this sort of sets the stage for trying to understand the geology and the tectonics. There's something obviously peculiar going on with the tiger stripes to make them make, for instance, the surface materials be coarse grained on either side of the fractures. Okay, so I'm going to move on to the next slide. And I put this in just to remind myself that the tiger stripes appear to be primarily the area from which the plumes are erupting. And this is a high-resolution view of the plumes. And particularly, if you look, you notice the plume isn't just a broad, diffuse cloud. There are jets that can be seen emanating from the surface right up to the limb. Now, our team leader, Carolyn Porco and Joe Spitali, worked on multiple views of these jets, and were able to actually triangulate the intersection with the surface from basically the eruptions, which at least 8 of these jets were erupting from the surface, and they turn out to coincide pretty much with the Tiger strike. So our game plan in the close-up flybys that we had in August and at the end of October was to get the closest high-resolution of the eruption site so we could tell geologically what makes them so distinct, or if there is something that makes them so distinct, very distinct from other fractures and rifts in the South Polar area and elsewhere. Can I go to the next slide? Okay. And now one of the things that motivated this was actually this this very high resolution 4 meter per pixel image that I'd mentioned earlier. We were not when that image was taken. The ISS was not actually the prime instrument that was pointing the spacecraft. In fact, what was happening back in 2005 was that the ultraviolet instrument UVIS was interested in imaging a star as it passed at close range behind as it passed behind Enceladus when Enceladus was very close to the spacecraft. The idea being that as the star passes close to the limb, if there was any atmosphere on Enceladus, the starlight would be attenuated according to the density of water vapor just above the surface. And so what we did is we rode along with that. We took our camera and we were sort of collimated with the same pointing direction as UVA's instrument. We started taking pictures as fast as we could. Now, in this particular case, because Enceladus was sweeping by the camera so fast, there was no way we could have actually targeted a specific site on the surface, even if we wanted to. So we basically just started shuttering the camera over and over and over again, and we were lucky enough to actually catch a 4 meter per pixel image of a region near the Tiger Stripes, but not on them. So this image now that I'm showing you is just a subsection of that false color mosaic. You see a scale there. If you look at toward the bottom of the mosaic, you'll see a couple rectangles, a small one and a larger one. Those actually represent, we're looking at an oblique angle at the surface, and you'll notice these rectangles actually represent the fields of view of the narrow angle camera, that's the little rectangle, and a larger rectangle, which is the wide angle camera. The wide angle camera, we sometimes use these two cameras in tandem. The wide angle camera gives us sort of a larger field of view and a context so we can fit this little tiny postage stamp and identify what's around it. So as you can see, these two images, the WAC and the NAC images, ended right up at the very end of a Tiger Stripe, not on it. It was right where the Tiger Stripe sort of splits up and ends up in a highly fractured area. Okay, if we go to the next slide, the next slide really just shows us what these images look like. So the image at the left is the wide-angle camera image, and you can see it's an area that's highly fractured at many different scales. There are areas that appear relatively smooth, other areas that appear very hummocky. And the little black square represents the field of view of the narrow angle camera. And we were quite surprised when we saw this image. That image is shown down at the lower right. And you can see a scale bar there at about 200 meters per pixel. And so what you see is even at this small scale, there are, for instance, orthogonal fracture sets that are all over the place. And there are these kind of very interesting 10-meter scale and smaller boulders. Or we call them ice blocks. You have to be careful when you geologically call something a boulder. Anyways, there are large ice blocks, larger than a house, and ranging down to smaller size. Some lower areas you can actually see sort of smooth deposits. And basically, this pointed to the perspective of a field geologist. We thought it was really terrific to understand what's going on with the Tiger Stripe if we could actually get right down to the surface as much as possible, to the point we were actually seeing individual blocks and boulders, and that this most probably would tell us a great deal about what makes the Tiger Stripes distinct. Okay, go to the next slide. Okay, so in what I'm going to show you, we basically had two opportunities to take what were called skeet shoot images, and I'll explain that in a little bit. But our scientific objectives are really to observe the morphological details of volcanic features at a resolution better than tens of meters per pixel, basically along the lines of that high-resolution picture that we want to look at structural variations related to their age and evolution. Eventually, these pictures become Rosetta zones. We can't take a lot of them, so we've got to be wise about how we use them. But they may provide us a key for understanding other areas of the surface that we're not able to map it to observe it. Use these as Rosetta stones for understanding a wider distribution of other examples that we were forced to do at slightly lower resolution, much lower resolution. We really want to ultimately map these as terrain units, identify systematic geological and tectonic relationships, and interpret their physical significance. So at this point of the game, we're mostly working on one, and probably have more to say about at the AGU conference coming up in December. But basically what I want to do is sort of get you started on the main images that that we've been. Okay, so what does it teach you? You've heard this term probably already multiple times. Now, why are we using this? I just want to remind you, at closest approach, at least in August, our altitude was only 50 kilometers, about 30 miles above the surface of Enceladus. And Enceladus was whipping by us at about 40,000 kilometers an hour, or 24,000 miles an hour. The imaging cameras basically, along with a lot of the other optical instruments, essentially bolted to the side of the spacecraft. And the spacecraft is as big as a bus. You turn the entire spacecraft camera. Now, we have two ways of turning the spacecraft. One is with reaction wheels, with flywheels, and the other is with reaction jets, little rocket jets. We generally prefer not to use the rocket jets. They can turn more quickly, but we can't point as accurately. So in this case, we use the reaction wheels to try and take our pictures. Now, the reaction wheels really can't turn the spacecraft fast enough to match Enceladus's velocity when we're this close to it, angular velocity when we're this close to it. In addition, it can't accelerate in an angular sense fast enough to catch up to Enceladus. So the idea of the skeet shoot is the same as it is from the sport, where somebody throws a clay pigeon across the sky, and in order to hit to shoot the clay pigeon, you have to raise your shotgun up and anticipate where the clay pigeon is going to be ahead of your bullet or ahead of your pellet, so that by the time the pellets reach the trajectory of the clay pigeon, they both intersect at the same point, and both basically arrive at the same point in space at the same time. And this is the idea behind the skeet shoot, that in order to make this work, we had to turn ahead of Enceladus quite early and ramp up the spacecraft moving in exactly the direction that Enceladus was going to be moving across the sky, and we had to wait for Enceladus to catch up and pass us by, and the relative motion of the spacecraft and the camera was such, it was slow enough that we could actually capture for a short period a series of sharp images, and by tweaking it, we were able to move those images and allow particular vent sites, as established by Spitali and Porco, to pass right in front of our camera when we wanted to take the pictures. Okay, so let's go on to the. I'm sort of said what the next slide is all about. So let's go on to the slide after that. Okay, the first skeet shoot was the Enceladus E4 flyby on August 11th, and what I've got here is a diagram that sort of summarizes what we tried to get, and what we I think pretty much succeeded in getting. And so that purple line is the terminator. We're looking at the south pole of Enceladus in this sort of cartoon. The terminator is the demarcation between the illuminated on the left and the stated, the in-shadow part of Enceladus on the right. So the spacecraft, when we first will start taking pictures, we just crossed the terminator, and that picture labeled 1, we were able to obtain it about 8 meters per pixel. And as we move further and further, as the spacecraft move further and further away from Enceladus, of course, the pictures get slightly, more and more low in resolution. So we start out at 8 meters per pixel, and by the 7th skeet shoot image, that's about all we were able to do in a skeet shoot sense. By that time, we're up to 28 meters per pixel. But all of these, as you'll see, were very valuable. Now, the sites that the actual vent eruption sites that were triangulated by Spitali and Porco are shown in red. So we were able to catch at least 4 of those different sites. And we'll see those in one moment. Let's go to the next site. the next slide, there was a second steep shoot on October 31st, and this is a cartoon similar to what the previous one was, only in this cartoon we have the benefit of having seen this area as a mosaic at a little bit higher resolution. So in this case, we start off with two more steep shoot images than we did in the previous flyby. If you look toward the center, you'll see steep shoot image number one was about 8.6 meters per pixel, and then they projected progressively grow to lower and lower resolution until we finally get up to steep shoot number nine, which is about 39 meters per pixel. We got a nice collection of the hot spots once again, or of the eruption site, and I think it's probably about. You'll see there's one purple image, graphic box at the bottom. That wasn't an X image. We were so close to the surface at the time we took that we couldn't get an image with an AC image, but the WAC, the one that's 10 times worse in resolution, still managed to get us a pretty decent shot, in which we got the plume site number 5, event site number 5. Okay, next slide. Okay, what I'm going to show you here is sort of, as you probably noticed from some of the those previous cartoons, these images, we tried our best to sort of make these images fit together almost like a mosaic, so we can actually get a sense of the terrain and how it varies across the tiger stripes. Okay, if you look at the, for instance, on the left, this is from the first, both of these actually are from the first flyby, the first ski shoot setup. The tiger stripes themselves, we've identified the two vent sites, 1 and 5, one on bag. All these tiger stripes have names, so they're all named after 1001 places in 1001 Nights. So Baghdad, Salkis, and Cairo. So you'll hear a lot of Arabic names here. Baghdad and Cairo, though, are two of the tiger stripes where we know there are eruptions taking place. So 1 and 5 actually show that we've nailed two of the sites right on. You see what you see here are the tiger stripes. They're about with those raised planks. They're about 2 kilometers across to give you some sort of a scale. When you look at these tiger stripes closely, you see that there are sort of upraised planks that lead to the central valley. And one thing we hadn't seen before in the valley floors were things that people, when they look at there, they're sort of very narrow ridges that stick up hundreds of meters, and they may only be about 100 meters across. To many people on our team, they look like shark fins. So you have tiger stripes with shark fins. It sounds like a bad science fiction movie, but we took a lot of interest in trying to figure out what these things were, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. But essentially what you see here is that where the eruptions are occurring, the tiger stripe flanks at this scale appear relatively smooth. When we look closer, you'll actually see individual ice blocks sticking up. But one thing we did notice is that wherever there was an eruption site, pretty much we saw the same type of surface texture. We saw sort of a smooth area, almost a fluffy-looking area, which with blocks up to 10 meters in diameter, or maybe a few tens of meters. And we noticed that these tiger stripes rifts had narrow ridges extending up from the floor. Sometimes, as you can see, those ridges sort of clump together like a bunch of grapes. You can see an example there near Baghdad. Okay, there are some other trains also visible here. You'll notice some things that look sort of like ropey bands. These occur to either they basically occur in between the tiger stripes. They're a little bit distinct from the stuff that you see at the near the top near Baghdad on the other side, which is a more complexly fractured terrain that we've come to call reticulated plains material. On the right side here, you see Damascus, where we have tiger stripes, the hotspots 2 and 3, and again you see this ropey terrain below. And above, you see the ropey terrain grading into sort of another kind of strange-looking smooth terrain. And it turns out that these features coming up from the top are old tiger stripes that are actually extinct. They're no longer active. They're not embedded in this ropey type of terrain at all. They appear to have been inactive for a very long time. Probably won't talk too much about that. We'll focus for most part on the tiger stripes themselves. Go to the next slide. Okay, and this is again one of our better mosaics of Damascus salt. This is one of the tiger stripes. showing some details of two of the hot spots. And again, what you see when we look up close is we see that, for instance, the inner walls of the Tiger Stripe are sort of striated. We don't know if it's striated because, for instance, there may have been boulders or blocks sliding down slope, or, for instance, those slopes were scoured by the vent eruptions themselves. My own personal prejudice is that they represent tracks of boulders that have mass wasted down slope. Again, you see this sort of knobby-looking ropey-looking terrain that form bands that run very crudely parallel, but not exactly parallel. They're sort of curvilinear, but they have scales on the order of a kilometer. They're similar in scale to the sizes of the individual flanks of the Tiger Stripes. Okay, go to the next slide. And this again shows a close-up scale of Baghdad Sulcus and one of the hotspot number six. And here we actually get a fairly good look at a clump of these shark fins, where they seem to be sort of clumped together. And you can see that they seem to follow either the edge of the fracture or the rift floor. And they're almost lens-shaped. They are like shark fins. We would use the term, a geologist would use the term lenticular, as in lens shape, to describe the shape of these kind of odd ridges or hills. And again, this is to either side of this Tiger Stripe, you can begin to see more surface details of this ropey terrain that's still a bit mysterious to us. Okay, finally we get to vent site number 7 near Baghdad Sulcus. Of all the vent sites, this is one that doesn't seem to have landed directly or emanated directly from a Tiger Stripe. It's in an area adjacent. And it's also near the distal end of a Tiger Stripe. It's not near the middle. It's not close to where these other guys were. It actually is starting to get into this terrain that's not so different from the terrain that we saw in 2005. This is an area of a terrain that we call reticulated terrain. It's a very highly fractured terrain that exists at the near the tip of the Tiger Stripes. And that's probably what I want to say about this. Let's go on. Okay, now I've sort of progressively moved up in detail here. What I want to show you are sort of the two closest images, the two highest resolution images that we got out of these skeet shoots. The first one that I'm showing you is actually from the second skeet shoot. This is our 9 meter per pixel image, again showing the details of the ropey material that fall in between Tiger Stripes. And what you can see here is that it's fractured right down to the limit of what you can see. The fractures are very often sub-parallel. They sort of break the surface up into these sort of little fadey ridges. Over the surface of this, over the top of this, you can see lots and lots of little blocks. And occasionally in areas, you can see little smooth deposits. So if you were to ignore the topography here, you might, to first order, say that imagine that the blocking materials that are distributed over in this terrain may not look that much different than the blocking material that we saw a little earlier from 2005. But you have to imagine what this scene would look like if you didn't have the ropey terrain there, just the material that's sort of spread over the top or spread throughout. Okay, so now we'll go down to the next dish. I'm sort of mentioning this because we'll look at it again a little later. Okay, our first skeet shoot image on our first skeet shoot actually ended up being about 10 meters per pixel, and it was between Alexandria Sulcus and Cairo Sulcus, two of the Tiger Stripes. Unfortunately, we were very close to the terminator there, and so what you see are a lot of shadows, but in between the shadows, you can get a pretty good glimpse of some variations that we see in surface details. Up in the upper left-hand corner, I think that may actually be, I haven't really pieced together where that is. It looks actually like it might be the extension of the outer flank of a Tiger Stripe. And you'll see there are individual blocks there, but there are also smooth deposits along these flanks. So we may be near enough in this case to a active region of a Tiger Stripe that this too represents this type of fluffy material spattered with blocks of ice. Down more toward the lower left, again, you see an area that's somewhat hummocky with a large distribution of blocks and spread over these ridges and valleys that are caused by, are produced by this ropey-looking terrain. Okay, finally, you know, to really get down to the best details, what I've done here is just tried to take, if you look down to the very, in this last slide, to the very lower right, I've basically projected all of these images so that they're about the same scale. And that is the same scale that the image that we saw in 2005 is in the panel in Labor Street. So we're basically seeing these at all the same scale. And just a cursory look at these and the size of the boulders, for instance, size of the ice blocks, your eye at least tells you that there's not a huge difference. We're covering fairly broad expanse of the South Pole from the centers of the Tiger Stripes all the way out to just the edge. In all cases, boulders, and at least in many cases, we also see localized smooth deposits. We do see variations in texture, for instance, particularly in the peninsular terrain or the ropey terrain, the ones labeled C and D. You can again see little plates of material that have been fractured sticking up. We're in the process, we've had this data not long enough to really do a thorough analysis, but there's, as you can see, it's a very rich mine of information. It's maybe, you know, no more than a couple dozen pictures. We're going to get a ton of science out of this. Let's see, I think, okay, the very last thing is we were maybe a little too lucky in taking these skeet shoot images. We were trying to see all the hot spots we could. I keep saying hot spots. I'll talk to you about that in a minute. All of the vent sites we could, and we saw them. But what we were lacking were a lot of images of things that were not active. And so one question was, can we find anything on a Tiger Stripe that looks like it may be older, for instance? And maybe has a different surface texture, maybe a different gradational morphology, gradational structure that suggests that as Tiger Stripes get old, they may change their appearance and they may develop different characteristics. So there is one little branch of something that looks that way. On this image of Baghdad salt, this is again a mosaic you saw before. On the right, I've just colored in the different terrain units, and you'll see a little key. On the left, I've colored in the terrain units, and you'll see a key for these different types of units. I'm going to go in detail about this, but I will point out that when you look at the fresh Tiger Stripes, the active Tiger Stripes, you see these smooth deposits that I've painted red, and down where they appear to get older, you see this pink-looking unit. When you look at those close up, okay, the smooth material is, as we were talking about before, there's a fluffy deposit with blocks and boulders spread over them, but the fluffy material filled in any cracks you might have seen. As you move toward this area that's more of a platy deposit, and you look up close, no longer are the little cracks and little structures, plates on the surface, buried by fluffy stuff. You begin to see the cracks penetrating through, or not even being buried by fluffy stuff. There's some indication that as Tiger Stripes get older, they cease to be covered with this fluffy material, and they begin to develop more of an armored or platy appearance. Okay, I'm going to go to the next slide. Well, as you imagine, these shark fins really sort of capture our imagination. There was a heck of a lot of discussion, exciting discussion on our team when we saw these images about what are these things, what might they be. So there were a lot of thoughts that, well, perhaps they're spatter cones. They're deposits of sticky ice, for instance, that might have been vented from the cracks and clumped together or fall out in the valleys. But some of the people on our team who do dynamic calculations say, well, you know, based upon the thinness of the plumes that people are measuring, the dynamics that we calculate in the models, that doesn't seem to be too feasible. It's a theory or a hypothesis that we might need to think about, but In searching the literature, we came across a feature that the oil field people are familiar with, called a positive flower structure. And this is especially interesting because it occurs in an environment where there is both shear and compression. In other words, if you imagine that one side of a tiger stripe can slide against the other, sort of like the San Andreas Fault, and at the same time, it can be pushed, and smashed together, then material that's in between, that's actually caught in the crack, or maybe even making up the walls of the Tiger Stripe, can be extruded out or squeezed out like toothpaste. And It turns out that there are features that are sort of reminiscent of this on Earth, called positive flower structures, and they have sometimes have a characteristic shape. They look like little, if you see the cartoon there, they're sort of like little loaves of bread that are lined up. And I couldn't help noticing that some of our pumps of these shark fins bear a rather remarkable resemblance to this. As you can see in the cartoon, these loaves of bread are sort of separated by diagonal cracks. And I would argue that you could probably say the same thing about the shark fins on the right. So this is really interesting from a theoretical point of view, because there are a lot of theories right now trying to explain what the role of tidal flexing of Enceladus might be in controlling whether or not the eruptions take place at a particular time. If during the tidal, for instance, during certain times in Enceladus's orbit around Saturn, if the tidal flexure of the surface opens some fractures and not others. One of the theories, one of the hypotheses right now that's been advocated by Nimmo et al. And Pappalardo et al. And some others, is actually that shear heating, that actually this rubbing of the walls of the fractures against each other during tidal flexure could produce heat that would release some of the water vapor that we're seeing in the plumes. And so what we're looking at here, if these are indeed positive flower structures, these are materials that would be extruded and produced by the same mechanisms that this theory of shear heating proposes. And so I think that we're just, again, we have a lot more to think about. None of these are conclusive, but I wanted to point you in the direction of where we're going. And for those of you who want to tune in or at least look up on the web in December, we're going to probably be reporting some more interesting results at the American Geophysical Union in San Francisco. I'd like to turn it over to John Spencer. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Paul. So I'm going to be reporting on the observations with the SEERS instrument, which is a very different kind of beast to the visible camera that Paul's been talking about. And if you're looking at the PDF, this just continues on as the next slide after Paul's last slide. If you're looking at the PowerPoint, it's a separate file. So I hope you can find this. The first slide after the title slide shows a picture of our instrument, the composite infrared spectrometer. This is built at Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland and is operated from there. And what this instrument does is it's measuring the long wavelength heat radiation from objects in the Saturn system. And so the wavelength range is starts about 7 microns, which is about 14 times longer wavelength than visible light, and goes all the way up to 300 microns, so it's a very wide range. And we're not only measuring the total amount of radiation, but we're obtaining spectra. So we're getting a lot of detailed information on the wavelength distribution of the infrared heat radiation that we're seeing. And SEERS was designed to mostly to measure the composition of atmospheres for the atmospheres of Saturn and Titan, and it's very good for that. But when we're looking at the satellite surfaces, icy bodies without atmospheres like Enceladus, instead what we're looking at is simply the temperature of the surface and the heat radiation that is given off by the surface just as a function of its temperature, and that allows us to determine the surface temperatures from the infrared radiation. So that's a nice thing to be able to do. So the next slide shows why we got excited about Enceladus from a SEERS point of view. On this same flyby that Trina was talking about in July 2005, we got a good view of the South Pole in infrared light, and the image in the lower left shows our view there, and it's color-coded by the apparent temperature of the surface. And you see near the equator, we are seeing temperatures around 80 degrees Kelvin, which is about what you'd expect for sunlight warming the surface. But then down near the South Pole, we have considerably higher temperatures, and these are very hard to explain by sunlight warming the surface, which is what we see everywhere else in the Saturn system. There is no particular reason why the sun should be warmed down, particularly warming that region. And it was pretty clear that we were seeing heat coming out of these tiger stripes that Paul has been talking about, and this is nothing to do with sunlight. It's heat coming out from the interior. And we saw this again in November 2006 in a distant flyby, and that's the image in the lower right. And from these observations, by looking at the spectrum, we could see that actually we were getting temperatures quite a lot higher than would be apparent from these simple images. If you actually look at the wavelength distribution of the radiation, we seem to be seeing temperatures up to about 145 Kelvin, which is about minus 200 Fahrenheit. It's still very cold, but it's much, much hotter than the 60 or 70 Kelvin that you would expect the surface to be in this region. It is indicating there's a lot of heat coming out. The next slide shows a press release we did back in 2005 with the imaging team showing one of these images of the tiger stripes with a temperature scan superimposed on it that our instrument, the SEERS instrument, did. And you can see the temperatures are quite a lot warmer looking right at the tiger stripes than they are off to the side. So we didn't get another close look at Enceladus until this year, and since then we've had four flybys, and we've got data from the SEERS instrument on all of them. The one that was actually most interesting for us is one that Paul didn't mention, which is from March 2008. The reason Paul didn't mention it is because when we flew past Enceladus then, the moment we flew past Enceladus, pretty much, it went into Saturn's shadow, and it was in the dark. And that meant there was no sunlight falling directly on the surface, and it was very hard to take images. But that allowed us to look, have more time to look in the infrared at the heat radiation coming out of the fractures. And so the next slide shows the temperature map from July 2005 with the green lines showing where the tiger stripes are, and you can see that the warm area shown by those colored contours pretty much corresponds to where the tiger stripes are. But the large red rectangle is showing kind of the finest detail that we could see in that observation, and it's barely enough to separate one tiger stripe from another, and it all gets kind of merged together, and you're missing a lot of detail. So on this March 2008 flyby on orbit 61, we were able to get much higher resolution, and the little rectangle, or the little square, is showing the typical resolution that we got on that flyby. So we were able to map the distribution of the heat radiation in much more detail. And then the larger red trapezoidal shape shows the area that we were able to scan at high resolution during that flyby. So the next image is the result of that scan. This is now an image that we took by combining the visible wavelength map from the imaging camera with the heat radiation seen by the SEERS instrument. And you can see now which fractures are warm and which are not. And you see that there is heat coming out of these fractures all the way along the length, but variable amounts of heat that the some parts of the stripes are a lot of the tiger stripes are much warmer than others. And it's interesting actually to compare with what Paul was saying about active and inactive tiger stripes. We can see directly from the heat radiation which tiger stripes are active and which are not. And if you were to look in the latitude-longitude grid here at about longitude 45, which is about 4:30 clock position from the pole down around 80 degrees south, there is a fracture which Paul was showing had a slightly different texture, and you can see there is no heat coming out of that fracture. You can see it in the images, but it's not producing much heat, so that indeed is an inactive fracture. And then again, at every point along these fractures, we were able to measure the temperature, and we got temperatures this time up to at least 180 Kelvin, which is quite a lot higher than we'd seen last time, not because it had got warmer, but simply because we got a better look. The next slide shows the same data in a little bit different form. This is now showing the data at its full resolution. The previous image, we blurred it out so you could get a prettier picture. But when you don't blur it, you can see a little bit more detail, and you can see the variation in temperature along the fractures. And now I'm showing where the plumes are that Spitali and Porco had seen, where the gas jets were coming out, at least the most prominent gas jets. And you can see that those are marked by the white stars, and the numbers and the numbering scheme is the same one that Paul was using. And you can see that the dust jets seen by the cameras tend to fall along the active stripes and tend to fall in the warmest regions of those stripes, though it's not a simple relationship. There are some warm areas that don't have obvious jets. So the next slide shows the next time we flew past in August 2008, we waited politely for Paul to finish with his skeet shoot and get all those beautiful high-resolution images, and then we did a scan with our instrument, and by the time the imaging was done, we were quite a lot further away, so this isn't quite so detailed, but you can still see as we swept across, we picked up the heat radiation from each of the four tiger stripes, and we see pretty much the same distribution as we saw before in March. The next slide shows how we compared the distribution from the two times, because we were very interested to see, are these fractures very steady in their heat output, or are they varying? And so we divided the heat radiation along each of those fractures into each of these boxes and added up how much heat was coming out in each of those boxes, and then in the next slide we plot the heat distribution along the tiger stripes on each of the along each tiger stripe for those two flybys, the one in March 2008 and the one in August 2008. And so now we can get a bit more quantitative, and we can see very consistent distribution in most cases. But the Baghdad tiger stripe, there does seem to be a hint of changes between the two flybys. And we're still looking at this in more detail and trying to convince ourselves whether this is a real change or it's just the result of a measurement limitation. And then the next slide shows the temperatures along the tiger stripes. We were able to measure the temperature in each of those boxes independently of each of the other boxes. And we don't really see any obvious changes, except maybe Alexandria is a little bit cooler, though we've seen temperatures again around the 160, 170 Kelvin range in these observations. The next slide shows the data we got while we were riding along with the skeet chute that Paul was talking about from August 2008. And here these little, mostly blue lines show the area scanned by our detector at each point along that scan. And you see the length of those lines getting steadily bigger as you go from the right-hand side to the left-hand side as we were pulling away from Enceladus and seeing larger and larger regions as time went on. And the blue colors are where it was pretty cold, and then the red colors are where we saw high temperatures. And you can see that the high temperatures are pretty much on the tiger stripes, except, interestingly enough, at Cairo, where it's looking like the most active region is not directly on the tiger stripes, it's off it a little bit. So we're seeing some variability there, or some things that you might not quite expect. And then the next slide shows an observation that we did in cooperation with the imaging team, and we asked Paul at the end of the skeet shoot to position the spacecraft pointing such that our short wavelength detector was perfectly aligned with Damascus Sulcus, which is one of the warmest of the tiger stripes that we saw, and the So the image in the lower right shows the ISS image with the size of our detector is a series of yellow rectangles superimposed on that. And you can see that Paul did a perfect job and got our detector perfectly aligned along that this warm part of the Tiger Stripe, somewhere between Plume 3 and Plume 2. And in the image in the lower right, which is our lower resolution data from back in March, which at the time we thought was really high resolution, the area we're looking at is between the two stars. On the lower of the two Tiger Stripes, it's the area that is white, which means it's the hottest region that we saw. The two stars are the Plume 2 and the Plume 3 sources. And we just straddled the region between those and got a nice reading. And so the next slide shows a spectrum where we're actually plotting the brightness of the heat radiation from Damascus sulcus at different wavelengths. And I have to apologize that the wavelength scale is given in wave numbers, which is something most people don't think in those terms. So technically, wave number is the number of wavelengths in a centimeter, and 1,000 wave numbers is a 10-micron wavelength. So don't worry about that too much, but we're looking at the wavelength range from about 9 to 16 microns here. And you see that at the smaller wave numbers, which is longer wavelengths, we're seeing more radiation. It's dropping off very smoothly as we go through the higher wave numbers or shorter wavelengths. And we can fit that with what we'd expect a surface at a given temperature to be radiating, and we can get temperatures quite accurately from that. And so in March, in the top figure, you can see we were getting temperatures of 152 or 193, in fact, depending on what wavelength region we were looking at. And the numbers in meters tells you how much material along the Tiger Stripes would have to be warm to achieve this. So you might have a couple of hundred meters at a temperature of 152 Kelvin extending all the way along the Tiger Stripes, and that's a small enough region that it would fit comfortably in the bottom of those fractures. Or the higher temperature area, we get an area of only about 30 meters wide at this higher temperature. Now, the bottom plot blows this up so you can see, you can compare the data we got in March, which is the black squiggly line, and it's kind of ratty because we weren't looking for very long, with the data we got in August where we stared at the at Damascus sulcus. And those data are actually hard to see because they fit so perfectly under the blue line, which is our theoretical model of what we would expect. But you can see that black line that's got a few wiggles just poking out from behind the blue line there, and that is that beautiful spectrum that we got as a result of Paul's nice pointing at the end of the skeet tube. The puzzle is now, if you look at that bottom plot, whereas in March we'd seen temperatures at about 193, which we said was above 180, just to be a little cautious. Now we're getting lower temperatures, more like 160. And we're inclined to believe the new temperatures rather than the old temperatures because the data are so much better. And if when we look at subsets of that data, we actually see temperatures up to about 167. But in these new, very high-quality data, that's about the highest temperatures we're seeing. So these are still pretty darn warm compared to what you'd expect at the South Pole of Enceladus, but not quite as hot as we thought before. And trying to make sense of these temperatures and see what might be happening underneath the surface, you have to start worrying about the physics of what's going on beneath the surface. The fact we're seeing temperatures up around at least 160, 170 on the surface means it has to be warmer down below. And we really want to know how much warmer, particularly does it get warm enough that the ice can melt and we might have liquid water down there that could be a habitat for life and could allow a lot of interesting things to happen. So the model we have here is we simply assume we have a crack at a particular temperature and then the heat spreads out from that crack and it warms the surface around the fracture and allows you to determine what the heat, the temperature of the surface would be and therefore what the heat radiation would be. And the little example in the lower right shows a vertical slice through a crack, and the crack is in the middle of that red triangle, and it's at just the melting point of water in this view, and you can see that the surface temperatures are quite a lot warmer than cooler than that, and from that red color indicating very high temperatures, we've got blues and greens on the surface, but from those you can infer the higher temperature. And the green curve now superimposed on the actual spectrum shows the best fit we can get to the data with a model like this. And we can fit it with temperatures that are a little bit lower than the melting point, more like 225 degrees Kelvin. And if we have three of those a few hundred meters apart, or maybe up to a kilometer apart, you might be able to fit within the Tiger Strike, then you can actually fit the spectrum pretty well. So we're working more on improving these bits and getting a better understanding of what's happening underneath the surface. And that is the story so far. We have data now from the two flybys in October, where we got more very nice maps of the distribution of the heat and more spectra. We're working on those and hope to have something again to show at the AGU meeting in December. And that's it for me, and I can now hand over to Sasha.
Yes, thank you, John. So my task here is to talk about the dust particles, what you can learn from dust particles you find in the vicinity of Enceladus about the processes going on the surface of the moon and in the interior of the moon. And the dust instrument is even more different from a camera than the Sears spectrometer is. And the first slide shows you how the dust analyzer looks like, and the purpose of the instrument is to measure the dust and the mass and the impact speed of dust particles. And dust particles here means particles in the size range of a few nanometers up to, let's say, 100 microns. That at least is the largest particle we ever detected. And the impact speed, the typical impact speed of a particle in Saturnian system is of the order of 6 kilometers per second. But by means of this instrument, we can basically determine the impact speed in a range between a kilometer per second and up to 100 kilometers per second. And this instrument is quite similar in some aspects to the instruments on Galileo and Ulysses. But in contrast to them, to these instruments, this instrument also includes a simple time-of-flight mass spectrometer. So the function principle is that the particle hits the spherical target at the bottom of the instrument, and as a consequence of the impact, the particle is transferred into a mixture of plasma and neutral gas, and the plasma is then separated in strong electric fields, and the positive ions are accelerated towards the detector in the center of the instrument, the star-like thing, and from that we can measure the time of flight of the ions, and this gives us an idea about the composition of the particles. This instrument is also capable to detect or to measure the charge on the particles. That's a very important physical quantity, since the dynamics of the particles is strongly influenced by the planetary field of Saturn. And you have to know the charge carried on the grains in order to get this physical process modeled correctly. This instrument, which is based on the impact ionization phenomenon, is capable to detect at least the standard software of the order of one impact per second. And this detection rate is not sufficient for the interior of the E-ring, where the impact rate may be of the order of 100 impacts per second, and during the previous flyby detected up to 50,000 impacts per second. In order to do measurements at least, or to determine at least the impact rate in such a dense dust-rich environment, there is a small detector piggy pack on our instrument that the tiny square box with the two black circles in front of the instrument. That's a so-called high-rate detector, and this instrument detects particles by means of the damage they do to two foils, a thick foil and a thin foil, and This leads to a polarization of the foil, and this change, the capacitance of the foil, can be measured and allows us to detect or to measure impact waves up to 10,000 particles per second. Okay, next slide. What I actually want to tell you in my part of the presentation is what you can learn from the dust measurements in the vicinity of the moon. Okay, the question you should ask when looking on to the famous plume picture is if the plume phenomenon as it appears on the images is actually what you expect how such a plume should look like. You may be tempted to say, yes, I expect such a shape, but this is actually not that's not true. The problem is that we know pretty well the speed of the emerging gas from the cracks. This was measured by two instruments, by the like neutral gas spectrometer INMS, and by the ultraviolet spectrometer UVIS, and we know that the gas speed or the speed of the emerging gas is of the order of 500 meters per second. And we also know the density and of the gas, and we also know the amount of gas emerging from the moon. And now suppose that the gas is escaping from within the cracks to the exterior. Then the flow speed of the gas, which was found to be of the order of 500 kilometers, will also transport the dust particles, the ice particles. So right now we don't care how the ice particles are formed. It's just the fact that the ice particles are transported via the gas stream from the interior of the moon to the exterior. And the gas conditions are such that that dust particles of micrometer size, and that's the typical size of a dust particle ejected by the moon, that these particles couple stiffly to the gas stream. And what you expect to observe is that all dust particles escaping from within the moon should have the same speed as a gas jet. And the gas jet speed itself is higher than the escape speed of the moon. So what you actually expect to observe is not this kind of plume, this stratified structure, which is denser, closer to the surface, and gets more dilute at higher altitudes. What you expect is a kind of a jet expanding into the Saturnian system, and that's not what we see. And this fact tells you something about what's going on inside the cracks. Since what you have to explain is how do the particles decouple from the gas stream and acquire significantly lower speed than the gas speed in order to form the plume. And the answer we gave to that is that we proposed that inside the cracks, which are bumpy, curvy, the particles collide with the walls. And when a particle collides with a wall, then the particle is stopped. The particle decouples from the gas flow. And as a consequence of that, the speed of the particles gets modulated. You get a deterministic dependence between the particle size and the speed of the particles escaping from the cracks. And this can be modeled, this can be expressed in terms of the assumed size or width of the crack, and to our surprise, it turned out that there are only two parameters which describe the phenomenon. The first parameter is the size of the smallest structure, and the second parameter is the ratio between the opening of the crack and the depth of the crack. And this can be used, next slide please, to determine the conditions inside the cracks. Since what you find from such model calculations is that assuming reasonable opening sizes of the cracks and a reasonable dynamics of the cracks, that means that the crack is expected not to to be deeper than the size of the moon, things like that. If you find the relation between this parameter and the temperature inside the cracks, and the consequence of the model is that that inside the cracks has to be a temperature close to the melting point of water. So the shape of the plume, the morphology of the plume, the dust particle densities measured by the dust instrument, the gas density measured by the neutral gas spectrometer, and the appearance of the plume itself. If you all put together, you end up with a scenario that such phenomenon actually requires to, temperatures inside the cracks, on the bottom of the crack, which are close to the melting point. Excuse me. Okay, next slide. What we also did, we looked into the ejection process or the emergence of the particles into the E-ring. So this image shows you the plume and the alignment of the particles ejected by the plume with respect to the ring plane. And obviously, since the dust source is in the south pole area of the moon, the particles are ejected preferably in minus D direction, orthogonal to the ring plane. And there's only a certain number of particles which are ejected faster than the escape speed of the moon, and only these particles can populate the E-ring, which is fed by this moon. Next slide. And we performed numerical simulations of the particle ejection process where we put in everything we know or we knew about the locations of the dust jets, which were determined by Spitale and Porco. We put in the interaction of the particles with the electromagnetic field, but since we know the charge and the evolution of the grain charge, the model also includes the disturbance by the gravity field of Saturn due to the flatness of the moon, and we used as the initial conditions of the ejected dust particles the speeds and the mass distribution of the particles, which we derived by means of the model I explained at the start of my presentation. And when you use this model, you can determine the vertical profile of the E-ring in the vicinity of the moon. This is shown on the next slide. So what you do is you simulate the ejection process by means of first principles. You assume that the particles are ejected from only the jet sources identified in the images, and you end up with a ring profile which almost perfectly fits the measured ring profile by means of the dust detector. So this plot shows you the dependence of the impact rate from the height above and below the ring plane, and the solid line shows you the prediction by the model. And the match is almost perfect, and the consequences or the meaning of this fit is that actually the spikes in the model are the individual dust jets on the surface of the moon. So this means that from the vertical profile of the E-ring in the vicinity or at the orbital distance of Enceladus, you can actually at least monitor the variation of the dust production of the various individual jets, and you can also at least constrain whether the alignment and locations of the dust jets on the surface are determined correctly, or if there are additional sources. So since the spacecraft performs much more ring plane crossings than close flybys at the moon, this provides us with a unique opportunity to do a long-term monitoring of the activity of the moon. Next slide, please. So in order to demonstrate to you how well the model actually works, this plot here compares the model predictions to the data CDA, the cosmic dust analyzer, obtained during the flyby in in orbit 11, in August 2005, and the red symbols, these are the dust counts by the dust detector, and the white curve is the best fit on it, at the best prediction by our model. And it shows you that during this flyby, the spacecraft actually only crossed two dust jets. Spacecraft actually flew only to the dust jets on the Damascus crack, and so it was really sheer luck that the spacecraft detected, that the instrument on the spacecraft detected during this flyby the dust jets at all, since it is only a matter, it was only a matter of a few kilometers. if the ground track would have been shifted by, let's say, 20 kilometers, we wouldn't have observed the thing. Okay, next slide. What you can also do with such a model is you can actually calculate where the dust particles fall back on the surface of the moon. And there's no surprise that that most of the dust particles fall back close to their the locations of the jets itself. And it's only a minor fraction of the particles, of the jet particles, which actually are capable to hit the surface in the equator environment of the moon. And this tells you something. Such models tell you something about the surface erosion of the moon by means of the meteoroids. This basically tells you that that everything you see on the surface, the erosion processes can't be due to the dust particles, since the impact rates are way too low. Only in the vicinity of the cracks itself, the mass deposition by the ice particles is actually important and relevant. So the other unique property of our instrument is that we can tell you something about the composition of the dust particles. This is shown on the next slide. Since Enceladus is the major source of ring particles, it's actually sufficient to determine the composition of the ring particles itself in order to learn something about Enceladus. And excuse me. To our surprise, we found that the ring particles are not pure water ice, at least not all of them. This is what you actually expect for such an environment. There are actually four populations of particles. There is the first population, which are pure water ice particles. They are of the order of 40%, 50%. It a little bit depends on the environment where we detect the particles. The second population are water ice particles with a small organic or rocky impurity embedded inside the, within the particles. And the important point here is that this impurity is solid. It's not a material embedded in the matrix of the ice particle. There's a third population, which is a quite surprising one, and this is a population of sodium-rich water ice particles, and the fourth population is an iron-rich non-water ice population, and those particles, they do not originate from Enceladus. They are probably even of exterior origin, but these populations only constitute of the order of 1 to 2% of the ring particles. So the next slide shows you the most abundant two composition types and how such a spectra looks like. The population one, pure water ice. The best explanation we can give for the origin of this particle type is the surface of Enceladus, since the E-ring particles or micrometeoroids from the exterior of the Saturnian system, which strikes the surface of the moon, they produce fresh particles. And since the surface of Enceladus is clear, very pure water ice, it's very likely that the particles produced by this mechanism are also should also be pure water ice. And the spectrum shown here shows you the typical appearance of the pure water ice spectrum. And it's a cascade of lines equidistant in mass, and these mass lines are formed of the hydronium ion and of neutral water molecule. And the second population, population two, water ion plus an impurity, first of all, the difference in the spectrum is quite apparent. There is an additional feature with a mass around 29. And the unfortunate thing with time of flight mass spectroscopy is that there is some ambiguity involved, since mass 29 can be attributed to various types of materials, of molecules and atoms. So, of course, there is silicon with a mass of 28, but it's also possible that certain organic compounds have a similar, produce a similar mass line. And the second feature in such a mass spectrum is the feature at 42, which is probably potassium, or a compound formed from the water molecules with another constituent. An in-depth analysis shows that that here the additional material inside the spectrum has to be a solid material. It's not possible to produce such a spectrum by molecules and elements of the matrix of the particles. And so it's very tempting to propose that these particles, the population two, that they originate from inside the plumes, since probably the best explanation for the production mechanism of the ice particles is that the ice particles are forming, nucleating in the descending water vapor inside the cracks, and the nucleation works far, far better if there are tiny nucleation cores within the gas stream. As soon as there is a nucleation core, water vapor starts to condense on the surface of nucleation core and forms dust particles. So it's our best explanation is the population two particles are particles originating from inside the cracks, and that was our main goal to determine during the previous intended flybys. However, since the impact rates were that high, the mass spectra of the particles detected during this flyby overlaps. And so our group is right now kept busy with disentangling the overlapping mass spectra. So we obtained thousands of mass spectra. After deconvolving the mass spectra, I think the number will be even higher. And then we can really prove this claim that we can distinguish plume particles from surface particles and particles from other sources inside the ring. This can then be answered. So if it's possible, and we are confident that this is the case, if we can actually distinguish the particle or determine the origin of the particle by means of their composition, then you can do really exciting things with a dust instrument. Then you can, for instance, follow the transport of the particles inside the huge within the huge E-ring. You can determine whether with enhancement of dust at certain regions inside the ring is due to particles originating only from one particular source or not. You can study the mass transport to other moons, in particular to Titan and to the outer ice moons. And so give us perhaps another half a year and we can give you a decent answer to this interesting question. And my last slide just shows you how the mass lines we observe in our time of flight mass spectrometer are actually formed, since this is a little bit confusing. So what you actually expect when an ice particle hits a target is that the material gets ionized, the molecules are at least partially disrupted into their atoms or atomic constituents. And so what you would actually expect are only a very small number of mass lines, hydrogen, oxygen, H2O or H3O plus. But this is not the case. We observe much more Mars lines. And the reason for that is that within the impact vapor produced by the particle hitting the surface, the impact target of the instrument, again, a kind of chemistry is going on. So as soon as there, there are hydrogen ions formed, the hydrogen ion tries to capture a neutral water molecule to form a hydronium molecule, and as soon as a hydronium molecule collides with another neutral water molecule, then a so-called cluster ion is formed, and the cluster ions can be very, very large. And this is what the Mars lines are telling you. What you see is actually are actually clusters of neutral water molecules and an hydronium ion, and from the cluster distribution you get information about the the conditions inside the impact vapor. That's all what I can tell you right now about our findings. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you to all three of our speakers. This is Jane in outreach, and I've received five questions that came in through email during the talk. And if anybody else has questions, this is a great time to ask. I hope all of our speakers are on so we can thank them all. And if anybody has any questions, go ahead and say your name and spell your last name. That would help for the transcript. And then I'll ask my five questions that came in via email after that. Anybody have any questions? Well, then I'm going to ask mine. These come from a Saturn Observation Campaign member in Ireland, Deirdre Kellehan, K-E-L-L-E-G-H-A-N. And one of her questions is, have you been able to determine how fine or coarse the plume particles are?
That's probably a question to me.
Yes.
We know the size distribution of the plume particles. We determined the size distribution of the particles already in 2005 when we flew for the very first time through the jets itself. So the sizes of typical plume particles is ranging between half a micron and the largest plume particles are of the order of 3 microns. At least we haven't detected a larger particle in the vicinity of this moon than 3 microns. And that's a quite narrow size distribution.
Great. The second question is, are the outbursts predictable like geysers on Earth?
I could have a stab at that. We don't know yet. We have some ideas that the jets of gas and ice that come out may be controlled by the opening and closing of the fractures, and the fractures may open and close every day in response to the tides of Saturn. Saturn is pulling on Enceladus all the time and distorting its surface, and that's what generates all this heat. But that may also open the fractures at some points in the orbit and let gas and dust out and close them at other times. And so you might predict from that kind of model that you would see these periodic variations every day as Enceladus goes around Saturn. But we haven't really seen strong evidence for that yet. And beyond that, we don't know yet. We're seeing tentative evidence for changes in the heat radiation, and there's been some other evidence that things are changing from one month to another, but it's not very certain yet. We don't get to look at the plumes as often as we would like, and so it's hard to get a really continuous picture of what's going on.
Perhaps I can add here that our model assumes a constant production rate, and the deviations of the model predictions from the flyby results was never stronger than, let's say, a factor of 2. And this tells you that also the production rate cannot fluctuate stronger than of the order than factor of 2, and that's quite surprising.
Oh, that's great. That's nice. She has questions that are coming to all the different speakers. The third one is, has Cassini been able to measure how deep the slits are within the Tiger stripes?
Our first measurements were just done from shadow, projected shadows, and we were out, basically these were the depths of the valley, and they extended down, hundreds of meters. There's been work, photochronometry work, from Paul Shank in particular. He sees some tiger stripes that are maybe a kilometer deep. Now, that's a different question. That may be a different question than how deep the cracks actually penetrate into the surface.
Mm-hmm.
That we don't know for certain. There's some idea. I have a paper that's submitted right now, and other people have done papers as well in which we try and use the spacing of tiger stripes, mean like 32 to 35 kilometer spacing, to estimate how deep the fractures penetrate. Because as you might imagine, if you have tension on a flat plate, if you imagine that flat icy plate to be near the south pole of Enceladus, and you pull on it in both directions and produce tension, a fracture forms to relieve the stress. So once a fracture forms, the stress, the tensile stress in the vicinity of that crack drops to zero. But if you started walking away from the crack and could measure the way the stress builds up, eventually it can build up to a point where another fracture forms. And so the spacing of the fractures is sometimes a clue to how deep they actually penetrate. And so estimates that, there's a wide actual range of estimates, but people are saying something on the order of less than 10 kilometers to a few tens of kilometers.
Great. Okay, the final question is came in through email is, do the particles come out at speed? Would you say they explode out under pressure, or would you say the material seeps out?
Oh, it's exploding out under pressure. These are supersonic jets.
Great. Yeah.
And you probably won't want to stick your finger in one of them. We don't have a real good handle on the speeds, but it's hundreds of meters per second, definitely. And it's supersonic.
But the escape speed of the moon is 207 meters per second, and this means that the majority of the particles can be faster than that. Otherwise, the particles would just escape from the moon, and
right.
You wouldn't see a plume. That's right. That the particles which actually populate the E-ring, they have to be faster. But most of the particles escaping from the moon, ejected from the vents, about 90%, they have to be slower than the three-body escape speed. And that was a major driver for the model we developed in order to explain this discrepancy between the flow speed of the gas and the apparent fact that there is a plume close to the surface.
Does anybody else have any questions? Deirdre's final comment is that the images from Enceladus are just awesome, so I wanted to share that with the three speakers. Nobody else has any questions, we will not have a telecon in December because it's during the it'll be like the close to the end of the year, and we never do have the December Charm Telecon. And at this point, we're looking for some suggestions for topics that you would like to hear about that haven't been covered so far. So if anybody has any suggestions for topics to cover, you can send them to the Charm Leads email that is on each of the announcements that you receive. And with that, I'd love to thank our three speakers for an awesome presentation. And everybody have a wonderful Thanksgiving and holiday season.